welcome to this second Sidelights episode of the Narratives in Philosophy podcast. Rest in peace, PPPP. Today we want to talk to you about a few things. Problem of evil is something we discussed in our last episode that only got touched on somewhat cursorily. We also want to talk about the education system and freedom, what it might mean, responsibilities that might come with it, and various other topics that may happen to show themselves to us.
Yes.
As we go, who knows?
Through the sidelights, yeah. So last week, I feel like we started to go into the problem of evil. We didn't necessarily go very far by, I guess, my standard. But anyway, so we wanted to maybe talk a little bit more about that, clean that up a bit as a concept, philosophically, of course. As far as the teaching, you're a teacher?
I am a teacher, and we've kind of touched on the education system slightly, but before I talk about that, what is this amazing concoction that you have here for us?
Roughly, I've made short lattes, which is a term I think I came up with. They're about the size of a cortado, maybe 1 ounce bigger, but they're flavored typically with a nut-based sweetener, like a hazelnut or a vanilla nut, or there's various sorts. But yeah, it's do enjoy. We're recording in the...
Ooh, that is exceptional.
The AM today, so...
I just had that. That is just... Oh, that is good.
Yeah, the strength of this drink... I mean, like I said, it's not like that inventive, but it's one of my favorites.
Peel the skin back from your eyes like a big black cup of coffee.
It's one of my favorites because it is a milk-based drink, but it really highlights the espresso flavor while not giving up anything that you get from a latte. So it's this lovely...
It's exceptional, but there is one thing that's missing. Can you guess what it might be?
No, I have no idea.
Whiskey.
Oh, dear. Well,
welcome to 11 a.m.
Yeah.
Whiskey in our coffee. Kidding. That's not what we're doing. This is an excellent beverage. There is nothing missing. This is exceptional. Well, to Jacob's point, the educational system is a place I've worked for about 3 years now, and I have an interesting perspective on the educational system because I was homeschooled. And whenever you hear homeschooling, you probably hear an image in your mind of some very strange things. But homeschooling in the United States over the past 10 to 20 years, it's a bit more in-depth than that. Yes, there's definitely some privilege inherent in homeschooling because you have to have one parent typically who's able to stay home full time. So if you're caught in the two-income trap, as some people are fond of saying, it's going to be very difficult to do that. So it's very rare to be homeschooled, but it kind of harkens back to almost a classical education because the student has freedom typically, although there's many variants.
That's the thing, there's a lot of different emphasis.
So many variants in homeschooling.
Right.
But typically, it's a good general rule that the student gets freedom to study what they want to study. They get freedom to take classes at the community college in town. And they get freedom to work on various other skills that they might learn from their father, such as working on the house, if your father was present, which I know mine was present to some extent, but he was also very busy. But I think Jacob might have had more opportunity to learn from his dad than I did. And then you get to take cooking from your mother. So in addition to learning all of these basic science, math, and English skills that are emphasized so heavily, you're learning practicality.
Yeah, homeschooling tends to emphasize living life in addition to being educated.
Yeah.
So it's just this whole different segment. I mean, yeah, there might be classes on those, you know, quote-unquote practical skills in normal schools, but as far as homeschooling is concerned, it's way more likely that a homeschooler is going to be cooking, you know, 2-3 nights a week even for the whole family and, like, really learning those sort of things. Or in my case, fixing cars, building houses, drilling wells.
Manly man.
Yeah, clearing land. I mean, the list goes on
building
and on.
Building bunkers.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, and, you know,
anyways,
just,
go on.
That's just, you know, one aspect of it because it goes deeper than that. I love the thing Jacob said, living life. That's something that, to me, is a lost art. There's your book title, Jacob. The Lost Art of Living Life. put that in the self-help section of Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
But why is that a lost art? Or why would we even refer to it as that? It's something that the education system has me thinking about. And the sad thing is you almost have to look at the negative before you can see the positive.
Hmm.
When I see all these students who the only thing on their mind is college, they don't really seem to have a roadmap for anything after that. They don't have a roadmap for what it's going to look like when their aging parent lies dying in a hospital. They don't have a roadmap for meeting and wooing a spouse. They don't have a roadmap for all of these things that are deep, the intangible. So that's one thing that we're going to talk about today. We also have on the title, you might have noticed, something called freedom responsibility. The connotation of that is that responsibility comes with freedom.
Which is a well-accepted, well-established, like many, many historic statements have been made on this.
Yeah, and I really would like to talk about that because it seems apropos to our current events.
All right.
And we may or may not touch on that deeply. It might be a very, very sundry sidelight. But it is somewhat connected to the education system because supposedly the education system teaches one to have this responsibility.
Hmm.
To know how to take responsibility for their citizenship. But I think we'll get there.
Yeah, where do you get that from? Why is that a supposedly?
Well, we're reading, for those of you who don't know, this month we're reading John Dewey's Individualism Old and New, and something he says about the education system still holds true. The problem we have is that we're only teaching people how to be workers.
Yeah.
We're teaching people how to be laborers, money earners, consumers in an economic system.
Right.
Well, when you teach someone to do that, all they know how to take responsibility for is earning money. That's not the only aspect of freedom, economic freedom. Now, we will get into the weeds today that perhaps the only heuristic we have for defining any sort of freedom is a financial one. Maybe that's the best quantification we have, but there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
I have one question for you, though.
All right.
Probably more than one. On the problem of evil.
I'm ready.
Why?
Not really. I'm not ready.
I am ready for the problem of evil. I am going to own it so hard.
Yeah, go on.
Why is it that evil is conceived of as a problem? And you might consider, in addition to that, in what sense does evil pose a problem to philosophers? Like, why do they look at that and say, oh, this is a really big problem?
Yeah.
It needs solving.
It's a problem in the sense that it prevents people from accepting a belief in a deity. And so when we're talking about philosophy and metaphysics, we have to talk about those things which are beyond this world. And prime among those is the concept of deity. If you look at statistics globally throughout all of time for all of the civilizations that have believed in gods or God, it's staggering. Like, it's in the 90 percentile. I think, in fact, it was the high 90s, if I recall correctly. It's only since the modern day that atheism has had any hold at all. And even in the modern day, at least in the postmodern day, it's a relatively light grip that postmodernism has. Or, I'm sorry, that atheism has. More have moved towards agnostics in our lifetime, especially. But anyways, so it's a problem because we have all these people who believe in God, and yet this supposedly omnibenevolent, all-powerful deity doesn't, he allows evil to go on. And what's going on there? So it seems like there's a contradiction between what we claim this God to be, what millions and billions of people claim this God to be, and what we observe in our reality.
So, you mentioned the possibility of the problem of evil being solved. And I'm not necessarily asking if that's doable, but how difficult is it to achieve something like that?
Yeah, so what you mean by solved is basically we conceive of God in a way that it is compatible with evil existing in this world.
Hmm.
On the face of it, it's really not that tall of an order, because the problem of evil actually says there's no way for God to exist. So all we need to do is find one way for God to exist in allowing him, in where this evil exists as well.
So the problem of evil assumes that God doesn't exist. Is that baked into the problem itself?
It kind of is. The people who promote the problem of evil historically have been those who have a hard time with believing in God. So, I mean, imagine this, right? You've had something terrible happen in your life. Someone very close to you has died unexpectedly, and you were raised a Christian. What's going on? It seems like what you've been taught of God being a good God, even a good father, if you're in the evangelical tradition, it seems like he's not doing that. And so you have to somehow rectify the evil that's happened with the beliefs in God. So, yes, as far as means of reconciling this, there's the middle knowledge method, which I've kind of talked about last week. This is the Plantinga approach. Alvin Plantinga wrote a book called God, Freedom, and Evil. God, Evil, and Freedom, I think it was.
Yeah.
And roughly in this, he sketched out an extension of Augustine's free will theodicy, which is a solution to the problem of evil, and took it quite a bit further in order to kind of integrate a more Molinist approach, which is the middle knowledge that I... Molinists believe that God has a middle knowledge. And what that means is that he only knows all of the possibilities for the future perfectly. He doesn't know the reality of the future. Okay, so he knows an infinite number. I think it's infinite. It depends on your formulation. It might be arbitrarily large, or it could be infinite number of possible futures. Kind of depends on if you think tachyons exist, or if we're in a... that's a side note. So
it's interesting.
Yes, it's very interesting because, anyways, this approach effectively says God cannot create a world with free people where sin doesn't exist. And so what this looks like is if he creates humans with free will, that true libertarian free will, we could say, means that evil is a possibility. And if it's a possibility, humans will, you know, go down that possibility. Because it's human's choice. It's not God's choice at that point.
Interesting.
So do you see how that's
kind of
gets
that solved? Yeah. Absolutely. But perhaps I could play some hardball here with you.
Okay.
The person who poses the problem of evil might feel that he or she has still succeeded in that he's gotten one of the concessions that he needs.
Okay.
Omnibenevolent, omniscient.
Yeah.
Omnipotent,
yeah.
Omnipotency, all power. He's gotten there to be some concessions
almost
in
fragmented
that.
Or weakened.
Yeah, so okay. Now he can now continue the discussion and say, okay, well, now this God is somewhat more like me and like you.
Interesting.
He doesn't have the power that he needs to be that we've accepted in our definitional view of God.
Okay.
Therefore, why is he not just some higher being of an ancient
yeah.
race,
yeah,
now
yeah.
it's easier to make those kind of statements.
So I would immediately turn that around and say, would you rather have free will or not?
Well, if the discussion's about God, I would say that it's quite simple that I don't feel a need to believe in God anymore, because now he's not omnipotent. I feel that part of his attributes have been weakened enough that I feel safer not believing in him.
Weird. Because he is still omnipotent. He is still all of these things. It's just... So we need to talk about two things here. We need to talk about God in relation to time.
Yeah.
And we need to talk about one of my favorite topics, the condescension of God.
I see.
So these are the two other things that maybe we can get to this week in order to round out this problem of evil discussion.
Condescension of God, and what was the other one?
God in relation to time.
God in relation to time.
Yes.
Yeah.
These are two other large theological topics.
This is what's so complicated about the problem of evil, it seems, is you can't discuss it unless you've defined your conception
yeah.
of God.
Well,
not even that, but your conception of an attribute.
Yeah, here's the deal. Like, we're talking about a being, a person, who is literally outside of space and time by most conceptions that we... And so it's so hard for us to conceive of that and his relationships to us in space and time, that, yeah, we have to go down these other roads, we have to go down these complexities in order to correctly conceive of this God. That's what theology is all about.
Interesting. So, a bit of a side question here. How do you think the problem of evil, and this is just to kind of draw our circle ever wider for those who might not be as theologically, philosophically minded as us, how might the problem of evil affect the sciences? We've kind of laid out some theological and philosophical avenues here. I figured we could open some scientific doors.
Okay.
So how might this problem be a real thing to deal with in everyday experience in the sciences?
Okay.
Or is that even something we need to worry about?
Yeah, I'm not immediately sure how to answer that. I suppose we have to reconcile evolutionary theory. That's one thing that comes to mind with God's existence as well. And effectively, evolutionary theory is a very messy, you could even say, evil process. The survival of the fittest is something that often doesn't sit well with children because it seems like bullying and bullies win. And so we kind of have to sit back and say, well, is that really what happened? Is that what God, is that the mechanism God used in order to put us here today? My belief is, you know, kind of a straightforward no answer. If he is all powerful, then he could create us with age. He could create the whole universe in an aged form. And so this is a concession that says perhaps evolution on a macro scale could work, but God could also just make it happen because he does transcend time, because time is linked intrinsically with space.
Interesting. Yeah, and there's the problem of looking back into the past and being able to draw out data points from the past anyway in relation to scientific theory, but I don't even deem to talk about that. But it does seem that when one looks at the sciences, natural selection seems to be a widely accepted fact, survival of the fittest, a widely accepted fact, and I could see how that would pose a problem to an omnibenevolent, all-loving God. I like the example you used of a child. So then that brings us back around to square one. We have all of these avenues through which the problem of evil affects us theologically, metaphysically, philosophically, scientifically. How in the world would we walk down these avenues to solve this?
Yeah, it's tricky because, like we talked about the first few weeks, that what we can know is shaky. And this gets even more shaky when it comes to the things that are outside of this world. You know, we talked about knowledge acquisition. We talked about the sciences and the methods that we use in order to gain knowledge. And it's all extremely shaky and extremely tricky, like we pointed out the first few weeks of this podcast.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So you're right on point by saying, how in the world can we do this? Because really, in a perfect sense, I don't think we can. I don't think there is an absolute path. I don't think that we have a true logical chain to get to God, except perhaps some of the arguments we did last week. They'll get us close,
but we can never,
as far
really
as the attributes are concerned,
get all the way there.
I don't think so. I've tried actually quite a bit. I started to write on the topic, and I just, it's something that many people have tried.
Syllogistic paths.
There's a natural theology is generally a related field to this, where you try and understand God through natural means rather than what we would call divine inspiration or any other revelation. So
a question about one of the three things you mentioned, and for the audience, that's the middle knowledge method, the condescension of God, and God in relation to time. Regarding the middle knowledge method, how does a theologian open up this new category? You know, things
of middle knowledge?
Of middle knowledge, because, you know, we have...
Yeah.
Categories that have somewhat been defined for us. How do we open up this category?
Yeah, I'm not sure the origins of it. I remember learning about the origins. However, I don't remember the details or why it was necessary. I know it was kind of a counter to some Augustinian thought. Roughly, it's in order to solve the problem of free will.
Yeah.
So Augustine kind of held to the free will approach, but he didn't really define how it worked. He's like, we have free will.
It seems obvious. I mean, yeah. I'm able to pick up this coffee cup right now.
It seems like we do. And so that's nice. And maybe it just seems like we do. And it's actually deterministic. Okay, I can take that as well. And so the Molinists, these who invented the middle knowledge method, effectively, I guess, drew out a philosophical scheme wherein God really did allow us free will. And what it denigrated, in my opinion, I think it's real denigration, is God's knowledge of the future. And so I kind of roughly sketched out earlier, I'll go through it again in a little bit more detail. They actually would claim it doesn't really denigrate God's omnipotence omnipotence. Full knowledge. So they would actually claim it doesn't, which I'm more sympathetic to than I was 6 months ago.
Interesting. What brought you there?
A lot of it was the problem of evil. I'm freely admitting that.
Getting your mind around how much of a problem it actually is.
Yeah, and listening to old, we'll say, elders, very, very wise men discuss it was also somewhat convincing. There's certainly people on all sides of the conversation here.
Yeah.
I come from a very deterministic background as far as
do I.
Philosophy, as far as theology is concerned. The Calvinist tradition tends to lean that way. Although, if you actually examine the 5 points that have been codified, none of them are strictly deterministic. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I remember my preacher always used to say he was a 3.7 Calvinist, which, you know...
Was that an arbitrary number, or...?
It was an arbitrary number, but he always said that he didn't feel comfortable in puristic terms. He thought that the right way was somewhere between any of our conceptions of the right way.
Yeah, that kind of goes back to the middle road we talked about. Yeah.
So God has this middle knowledge. God has this middle knowledge where he can see all of the future possibilities, but he chooses to not decree what will happen with those middle possibilities. Is that fairly close? Here?
Yeah. Okay. So this is why we need to talk about the condescension of God, which is a major topic in theology from my perspective. One of the most obvious condescension is God became flesh. So in the biblical tradition, Jesus, who is God, one of three persons in the Trinity of God, literally became human for a time in order to redeem creation from the punishment of sin coming from God the Father. So, God can choose, in the case of Jesus here, to forego certain parts of himself, i.e., in this case, his omnipotence, his omnipresence, his all of those attributes we consider to be eternal.
So in a sense, he's so powerful that he can almost choose to tie an arm behind his back if he wants to.
Effectively, yeah.
Okay, this is good.
In the case of Jesus, right?
Yeah.
And I don't have to argue for this very hard, because any Christian across the table from me pretty much says, oh yeah, obviously that's what happened with Jesus.
You know, the thing is, if he's so powerful, he has to be powerful enough to set aside power. I can understand the interest in this middle approach and this condescension issue, because, you know, it's like...
So let me just take it out a little bit further.
Go ahead, please.
Because you're definitely on the right road here, but let me just tie the knot here. Basically, what a Molinist would say is that in relation to time, God, and this is only in relation to time, he's always himself outside of time, full Trinity, full deity. People even say that Christ, Jesus, never stopped existing with that Trinity outside of time. It's only in relation to time that he actually condescends. So this is really tricky. This is why we have to get into the relation of time.
Interesting.
But anyways, in relation to time, a Molinist would say that God does not choose, we could even go that far, to understand what happens in the future. So a Molinist might even go further and say he doesn't have the ability to, because he's created autonomous beings. That's maybe a... That's a tricky site.
That's where we get into the weeds a little bit.
Yeah.
Because then, in a weird way, it's like that narrow road.
Yeah.
You know, you go down this knife point, and everything is good. But then, you know, you're either falling off into, you lose free will, or you lose an omnipotent God.
Right.
You don't want to lose either one. I like the approach of him choosing to tie his arms behind his back.
Yeah.
Decided to make things more interesting for himself.
I think that that's apropos to creation in general. Like, why does God need creation? Why does God need a finite space and time in order to fulfill his goals? Like, what's going on here? And in relation to that, it's obvious that he has to condescend in order to interact with it, because all of space and time could not contain him in any way, at all, whatsoever. And so any interaction with space and time is a condescension. It just has to be.
Yeah. It's like the difference between talking to myself in my head and conversing with myself and then choosing to condescend into a chair and take time to talk to somebody else, which is something that we can understand. There's a certain amount of boundness that we accept on ourselves to be seated and to be engaged in conversation and communal thought. That's very interesting. So I can see how this would solve the problem of evil.
Good.
What might be some rebuttals to yourself? If you were to ask us to rebut yourself, how would you do that?
I think the main one comes from other Christians who really don't like Molinism. And there's a big group of them who absolutely reject it face value. Just no. God could not possibly not know the future.
It goes back to the definitional discussion of omnipotence. I mean, you either believe that God is literally all-powerful and powerful enough to choose to limit his power, or you believe that he's not powerful enough to limit himself.
And thus the Molinists say we actually have a more powerful God because he can limit himself in relation to time. Yeah. See why Molinism is convincing?
I can see. I also see the knife point that I don't want to fall off on either edge.
Yeah.
I think that, you know.
See, the condescension bit is actually what really has hooked me in, because when I make the statement, God has to condescend to interact with a finite realm, then it's like, okay, in what ways must he condescend? And it's like, well, one of those ways that he must condescend is in the relation to free will. He can't know the future. And so it's his choice from the very beginning of creation to make the finite realm, to condescend to do so, mind you. And then it's a very good thing when he makes humans with free will, and he condescends even more. God is an extremely humble God, okay?
Absolutely.
To do this with his creation. In the Christian conception, you know, we see he's proud, we see he's mighty, all of these things, but we also see his insane humility when it comes to Christ, when it comes to condescending to our finite realm.
So this is all well and good. All of this process of thought that you've walked me through, it sits well with me. I can respond well to it and agree with it. Now I'm going to put on a different hat here for a second. I'm going to put on the hat of a guy who, you know, is maybe in college and picked up Calvin's Institutes last week, and, you know, just got done reading Romans for the first time.
Nice.
So, first conception of Romans 1, you know, if we just want to summarize the first chapter, there's a creation, the creation falls away, the eternal attributes are eternally seen, but they choose to worship the attributes and not God. You get to Romans 2 and 3, everybody is under this sin, not just, you know, one group, Jew and Gentile are under it. Get to Romans 4 and 5, we have the propitiatory death and atonement of Christ. Romans 6 and 7, my experience doesn't line up with the fact that I'm supposedly saved, but it's still the way it is.
It's still true.
Consider yourself dead to sin. You know, you get into Romans 8, what an amazing thing. Beautiful, yay. Paul has a little party. Then we get to Romans 9.
Okay.
And this is where some problems get run into, because even though I can agree with the logic of all of this, we still have little humdingers that we have to work out here. So, Romans 9, verses 13, and I'm just going to read a little bit here. As it is written, Jacob, this is God speaking, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. And in context here, he's talking about why is it that the Israelite nation, who is supposedly chosen, isn't saved.
Yeah.
And then he says something to the effect of, not all who are Israel are of Israel. And he goes on, what shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? God forbid. For saith to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. So then, it is not of him that willeth, nor of him that runneth, but of the God that showeth mercy. For the scripture saith unto Pharaoh, this is referring back to the guy who said no to Moses so many times, and God says here, quote, even for this same purpose have I raised thee up, that I might show my power in thee, and that my name might be declared throughout all the earth. Therefore hath he mercy on whom he will have mercy, and whom he will, he hardeneth. Thou wilt say then unto me, why doth he yet find fault? For who hath resisted his will? Nay, but, O man, who art thou that repliest against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? Hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor? What if God, willing to show his wrath and make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction, and that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy which he had before prepared unto glory? Even us, whom he hath called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles. And this is the thing, this is the last barrier in my mind, because in context here, he's not talking about national benefits for the kingdom of Israel. He's not talking about merely physical benefits. There is a finality and a conception of the God spoken of here that he has some sort of ability, past, present, and future. And that, to me, I'm not saying Molinism needs to be thrown out. I am saying that perhaps the decree that he made covers a bit more than Molinists might be comfortable conceding.
Could be.
So how do we answer that?
Yeah.
And I'm facing this with just as much curiosity and desire to learn as you, because this is something that I do not have an answer for.
Okay. My immediate thought is to reiterate that God, in the Molinist formulation, has absolute foreknowledge of every possible path forward. And because of that, God is God through all of these paths. Okay? He's no less God because there's multiple options. He's so transcendent of time that given the plethora of options, it doesn't faze him, it doesn't, you know, it's not a problem for him to be God in all of these different options.
Sure.
So roughly, in our present moment, God is. In the future moments, God is, but there's just a whole bunch of options. It's almost like the physics formulation of infinite worlds. Like there's all these potential options.
Interesting.
And we don't necessarily actualize all of them. We certainly don't. We only actualize one of them. And God is condescendent in not knowing, not choosing, not for, you know, predestining one of these routes.
So he might not do that to some extent, but then in this passage we learn that he perhaps does predestine people.
What I think...
Things
yeah.
might not be predestined purely,
mm-hmm.
but
I think
salvation.
Possible. I think this is compatible with the Calvinist view with that what you've just said of God predestining people to salvation. When we look at that, roughly, people predestined to salvation don't have a choice in it. It doesn't matter how sinful they are in their whole life. I'll just say that again. It literally doesn't matter how sinful people are. If they're predestined for salvation, they will be saved. And so God, in his condescension to us, through his Holy Spirit in this case, will bring us to salvation. In our lifetime, he knows the routes by which that happens, and he ensures that that happens by his divine providence, by his divine will. Now, is this a deterministic method in the Molinist formulation? Still no. Somehow, all of the possible routes that you as a free-willed agent
You know, you basically what we're saying here is you don't have free will when it comes to salvation. In everything else, you might have free will.
Interesting.
That's the fracture I would have to give in the Molinist form in order to be compatible with this.
So I guess
and I don't know where real Molinists fall on this line.
What we have in one category of predestination unto salvation, and almost by nature of the fact that that category is opened up, there has to be a second category opened up, predestined unto wrath. And when we say predestined, I think that Jacob and I would agree, for those of us who are not theologically minded, what we're analyzing here is that God, before time was even in existence, is able, purportedly, to decree what will happen in certain things before they happen. He doesn't just have foreknowledge. In this, it seems that he decrees that something will happen.
Yeah.
So, I know that historically, and if you don't mind, I'm going to talk how this has been a struggle for me.
Absolutely.
Historically, the Molinist viewpoint, now that I've had you explain it, has actually been the way I have conceived of this and gotten around it in my everyday life, because it's easy to do something here, folks, called hyper-Calvinism, where then basically everything you do doesn't matter, because you make the assumption that because I'm predestined for either destruction or good things in the afterlife, nothing I do matters. That is not something that I don't think the passage teaches. You know, it's that knife point yet again. So the way I would explain it that I think is probably a Molinist viewpoint is that man cannot help that he is bound within time. So because he's bound within time, he's also answerable for his actions.
Mm-hmm.
He's also condemnable
for
his actions.
This is extremely important to point out, because it's not like salvation is the only thing that man, you know, can't choose. Man can't just choose to become God. Man can't choose to transcend space and time.
Yeah.
There's many things that our free will does not give us access to. We're not saying that free will is omnipotence. So let's be very, you know, very obvious when we say that.
Yeah, we're not free agent in the sense that we can speak into existence a universe.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
Our free agency is roughly, you know, living here in space and time and having autonomy. Effectively, it allows, you know, us to worship God, and it allows us to sin against God. And that takes form through living everyday life.
And that's the thing. Then you have a way to say yes to both viewpoints when you view it that way. Is man free and condemnable for his actions? Yes, because when you say yes to that, you're speaking from the framework of time.
Yeah.
Is God all-powerful and decrees either way or the other? Yes. So it's an interesting thing that, you know, it's almost as if science has helped us give this, because we have this idea now that time can be separable as a concept from our everyday experience.
Right? Okay,
conception of it. And space is also something that we have a conception of. I'm moving my hand through space. We have a conception of this, but it's not just a univocal thing. It's just a part of our consciousness.
Right,
you know?
Right.
It's separate from us to some extent. So because of that, we have to admit both sides of the argument here to be true at the same time. And that's something that I never have been able to get my super hyper-Calvinist buddies to admit. When they get annoyed when I say, yes, man has free agency and can be condemned for his actions, but yes, God has the ability to choose.
Yeah.
Like, no, man does not have free will. I'm like, well, what? You haven't defined free will yet. You haven't defined what judgment is. There's so many things you haven't defined. And God is still good in this, because it is not a bad statement to say men can choose.
Yeah.
Women can choose.
Like, then, we need that in order to fulfill God's purposes. Just to be really explicit here. One of the verses you were just reading was saying, you know, for God's glory, for his eternal purposes, for his divine power. So in order for that to be achieved, it seems logical that we have to be autonomous beings.
Mm.
It just seems that way. And I don't know how else to formulate humanity without being autonomous, without being libertarian free will agents.
Yeah.
So.
And that makes a lot of sense to me, and I'm a lot more comfortable with this, because we've walked down a knife path here, folks, where we've not lost the omni-ness of God. You know, there are definitely still some things that an atheist agnostic type might hurdle at this. I mean,
yeah.
The Nietzschean answer hasn't even been considered by us yet, folks.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you asked a question previously about, you know, what problems might people have with this, I answered it from the other Christian point of view, which is probably the more near and dear side, because it's, we're both, you know, we've both been there. But yes, there is the other side of this, what the secular people might hurl at this, what the Nietzschean philosophers may even counter with.
You get to the end of Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra, and one of the things that he presents as one of the nails in the coffin of him believing in this Germanic fatalistic God, because he was a Lutheran seminarian, was this ability of God to be the puppet master of every person at one point. And he describes that as just this unbelievably evil thing. And I think that when we get to Nietzsche weeks from now, we're going to have some serious difficulties discussing that, because not only does he discuss that, he also gets us to call into question, why do we accept that God gets to say what is good?
Right.
Why do we accept that good and evil need to be these pure moralistic categories? Why can't it be a...
I mean, I think the ontological argument kind of defines that, because, you know, God is intrinsically the greatest good. But anyways, move on.
Yeah, and, you know, there's the possibility there that genealogically, morals had a evolutionary genealogy, just like everything else. But those will be things worth talking about later on. I, to do a seamless pivot to the education system.
The first question
I would have is, do you think that students in our schools, one, are taught to have discussions like this, and two, do you think they want to have discussions like this?
That's good. No and yes. to be brief, although this is long form, so...
So laconic.
roughly speaking, when you're in the education system, and we've all taken, you know, obviously we're college educated, we've all taken classes in that classroom setting. You are getting a knowledge upload. You are not necessarily taught to interact, even. And that's just the first part of the things that we're doing, the first part of thinking like we've been thinking. So without interaction, there's not even a shot. Now, yeah, you know, there's teamwork, there's groups, there's question and answer time, all of that. All of those things, in the college system at least, are revolving around this knowledge upload concept. They're not even revolving around a research concept at the undergraduate level.
Yeah, and you know, the closest thing I ever got to a satisfying educational experience was my freshman year. There was something called an inquiry seminar. Now, from what people know about our book club, that's something we've tried to continue doing in as puristic of a way as possible. But basically, we were going over science writing.
Okay.
And we would sit in these circles in the classroom, all these freshmen, you know, who were hungover from the night before.
Yeah.
And we'd pull out this book on science writing, and the professor would ask these questions. Deafening silence would greet her.
Oh, no. Is that really?
Yes.
What was the point of this class, then?
Well, you know, we were graded on discussion, but the problem was, is I almost feel as people didn't know how to do that.
Yeah.
Even if they made it their senior year to the most AP of the AP classes, or if they took courses, that was probably for such a short amount of time that they barely dipped their toe in the water of this kind of learning
stuff. All of that sort of stuff is just revolving around the knowledge upload scheme as well. So it's just, I don't think it's...
But it was trying to become Socratic.
Yeah.
It was trying to become classical.
I mean, it sounds like that class was basically an introduction to, you know, be more like that. And maybe to answer your question a little bit more directly of how we can get there, although, anyways, I'll ask, how can we get there?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, when we think about the education system right now, anybody who's gone through it, and all of us have been affected by it to some extent, whether we went to community college, whether we went to public high school, private high school, there's this understanding, unless you are in the most classical of private schools, that the purpose of it is to pass a test, get a good enough grade so that a university lets you in. Why do that? So you can get a degree. Why get a degree? so you can become a functioning member of society. How do we define a functioning member
of
society? Somebody who makes
money.
Money.
You have a job and you make money.
And you have 2.5
kids. And thereby spend money and, you know, exist.
And you continue to propagate.
And all of the culture stuff, all the civilization stuff, that is left to be given to you through whatever means you choose, through whatever means are effective.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because so many of the central questions, such as what we just discussed for almost 30 minutes, that's the kind of stuff that has been dominating human mind and thought for millennia, and so many students don't have even a single perception.
Yeah, we're getting around to answering this question when we're, you know, adults, we've had kids. Like, this is pretty late in life to be struggling with this sort of question that's literally been on the top of humans' minds, on the top of thinkers' efforts for millennia, like you said.
Yeah, I mean, even the most, the largest critic against this kind of question, Nietzsche, why did he write his stuff? Because he's considering this question.
Yeah.
I don't care who you are, but we have a weird middle road that we've created now of people who don't even want to think about it, don't even want to consider it. And
see, that could be, but I said they do want to consider it.
That's true. I mean, and that's the thing. I remember one time I had a philosophical discussion after school with three of my students. They sat around the piano.
Yeah.
And I began asking them questions. And they were very excited by it.
See, that's the thing. Whenever you do get into these situations with anyone, really anyone, that I, at least in my experience, they're super engaged. I mean, I had a conversation not too long ago. It barely skimmed on Christianity from my perspective. It was mostly philosophical, and this guy just, like, he literally thanked me for having the conversation with him. Like, at the end, he was so grateful, and I was, like, just chilling, talking with him, like, I didn't do anything. I didn't give you a gift, you know. Anything for you. It was like I gave him a box of chocolates or something. Like, what in the world?
Yeah, and that's what we deprive our people of. If I had to delineate it, we deprive it by all of the quantification that's necessary to prove to the state that success has been reached. We deprive them of it by our standard of success. And we deprive them of it in that we interpret the separation of church and state as the separation of thinking humanity for millennia from public school life.
No, that's a different formulation than I've heard, but that's a good model.
We want to think about these things. It's not teaching a religion to think philosophically about centuries of thought.
See, that's the funny thing. In a more conspiratorial world, I would say, yeah, that's the idea. They know that philosophy goes down the road that we've gone down through this podcast.
Mm.
We've spent the last two episodes, more than 2 hours now, talking about God.
Yeah.
Why is that? Because philosophy and metaphysics, like we've been saying, naturally must get to the greatest metaphysical thing.
Yeah.
And what is that? It's the thing that almost everyone throughout all of history, throughout all civilizations, have believed in this God. So,
you know, a polytheistic pantheon or a great turtle that, you know, the world sits on its back of its shell. I mean, there is some infinite thing in the upward course. And that's interesting because you mentioned an idea of the upward movement inherent in this. You see that in Plato's cognitive framework. Everything goes up towards the good.
Yeah.
If we had to put where our students are today on this Platonic cognitive framework, where are they on that framework? At worst and at best.
One of the things you said at the opening, it was like episode 3, I think, they've not even ascended one level on the cognitive framework. I had to include that in the podcast. It was actually pre-recorded, like before we started. But anyways, it was so like funny that you were like passionately saying that. I feel like that's the answer. Like I could just insert that quote here.
Because at the bottom of it, guys, is images. And what are images? What we're discussing here is the cave allegory in Plato's story. All of us start out in this cave, and we can go out to the light of the sun and begin to consider these things, or we can sit and look at these beautiful shadows, some of the beautiful shadows, what might those be? I mean, I don't know. Some would say the institution of marriage is a shadow. Some would say the institution of a job. What other shadows might
there
be?
Another parallel here, and this might even be based off of the cave allegory is the Matrix, where,
yeah,
you know, it's red pill, blue pill, which would you rather? Mm. Not to bring along all the political, I guess, tropes that come along with that, but it's another more modern example of what we're talking about here.
Absolutely.
You know, basically, we live in a world where it's culturally acceptable to go on without talking about this stuff, without thinking of anything beyond the here and now. The only reason why people still think beyond the here and now, in my opinion, is the anthropological argument sort of reason, where we tend to think of God, where we have this sort of consciousness in us, this conscience as well,
yeah,
and they bring us towards considering infinite things.
Absolutely.
So,
and you even think of Heidegger, Heidegger's conception of being and time. And there's this thrownness that we all experience in the middle of time, and you know, you can't get around that, and he's not even coming at it from a religious viewpoint, but at the very least, there has to be something in our education system to get people to think about their own being.
Yeah, you'd their, think, you know.
Their own sein.
There should be.
Well, I guess in their case, their Dasein is the German word. Their there-ness.
Yeah.
Why is there a there-ness and not an over-there-ness?
Right.
And this is ridiculous. Some people are probably laughing right now. But guys, I'm sorry. German philosophy, it's ridiculous. But think about it. Why is there something and not nothing?
Yeah. Well, that's what we've been talking about the last two episodes.
Like, yeah. So that brings us to some of our issues here. Problem stated, quote, as the absence of any ability in the system to teach kids about higher ideals. If they get lucky and have a good teacher, they can learn those things, but even then it is difficult because that teacher will be so focused on getting the good test grades and thereby retaining his or her job.
I think to take the difficulty a bit further, you're going to have a hard time bringing that outside of that class. That teacher's not going to go along with you through all of life and mentor you.
Yeah.
And that might be necessary in the world that we're living in order to maintain that sort of critical thinking, even.
Mm. Absolutely.
Because the culture is so opposed to it, like we've been pointing out. Like, you are perfectly okay to go on through all of life without considering this stuff. Nobody thinks twice about it.
And, you know, I hate to memeify it, but it's interesting the generational difference here between boomers and millennials. When you look at millennials, they listen to people like Sam Harris. These very intellectual thinking through of things.
Yeah.
They want to really analyze things. They listen to people like Jordan Peterson. I'm not going to go all the way into some of the other pundits that people might listen to, but think about what our parents and their parents listen to. How do they conceive of their conception of reality? You know, you got Rush Limbaugh.
I mean,
you know, poning the libtards. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that is important. The conception of what is important is so different that it's almost comical.
Yeah. To be fair, there certainly were public philosophers in their day, like we have in today's day.
Oh, really?
Alan Watts comes to mind. Of course, he's more influenced from an Eastern tradition, but he certainly struggled with all of these questions from a philosophical
Indeed.
Standpoint. And he was very popular on radio. I know he had some TV sort of recordings that were influential. In the modern day, actually, we still have his voice inserted in, you know, with backing music, and there's a whole wide range, not a wide range, but there's, we'll say, several albums worth of
his recordings,
of artistry that has, you know, moved his work into the modern day. So there certainly were people back then. So I wouldn't bring it to the generational argument too far.
The generational argument probably isn't something I want to go down, but you did mention earlier this idea of classical education,
mm-hmm.
a teacher being with a student long term, having a ability to teach them about many different things.
Yeah.
You know, in the olden days, this was something that only the wealthy could acquire.
Yeah,
so
a tutor or a mentor.
Yeah. So classical education might be seen as a potentially better model in that it focuses on an outward gaze on the earth, captivated by its beauty, instead of merely focusing on the things needed to achieve a good test score, thereby leading to monetary gain in the long run. And I know we've been very unkind to the education system here. So I'm going to try to come up with some other things for us to discuss, because there might be some wisdom in the way that it is conceived of presently. I have to admit that.
Well, I think the way that it's conceived of presently serves the purpose of maintaining the state.
Yeah.
Roughly, when you have anything that's state-funded, it serves the purpose of the state as a whole. It doesn't serve the purpose of the individual.
Interesting.
So, if we were... Let's just conceive of this. Let's say no schools were tax-funded. They were all private. Because right now, every... You know, it's basically... the payment for schools is, you know, distributed across property owners, homeowners. At least in our state it is. I don't know how it is other places. So... In a different model, we would just reshuffle that to be everyone who uses the school systems pays for it. What would the school look like then? Well, it would be whatever the people paid for it wanted to look like. Who's paying for it? The parents of the kids, in this case. So, if you actually had that different stakeholder involved here, right? In the current model, the stakeholder is the state, the school boards, all of that.
That term stakeholder is actually a very important term in education.
Even though it's tax funded, yeah.
Yeah. Because that's what people in the education system claim. Like, our principals talk about this all the time. Who are our stakeholders? Well,
yeah.
The community, the parents, the students. But the reality is almost what you just described. The real stakeholder is the state who receives the tax funds and gets to applicate them.
Right.
Specific.
And in a practical sense, this works through the standardized testing that's required.
Yeah.
Like, because you have to have people pass those standardized tests in order to maintain your funding as a school. That's just how that works. So in order to do that, you have to teach the tests. And it's just perpetuated more and more and more the further we've gone towards that model with, you know, core curriculum and all of it. So
State Board of Education and all of that. Okay, well, that completely threw out what I was going to bring up because, well, maybe it doesn't. I'll just go ahead and read it. Is there any other heuristic for gauging success in the educational system besides career success? Could there be any other heuristic that the state could bring down? You know, I'm not going to go to a perfect world and say all the schools are private or everyone is beautifully educated by a personal tutor at home.
Right.
In a world where we have to mitigate for all of the negative things.
So from a state's perspective, I don't think there's any incentive to change. Unless you were extremely forward-looking and, you know, had a focused vision of the future, I don't think there's any reason to change. Because, like we've been talking about, we're trying to make citizens who have jobs who pay taxes.
Yeah.
And perpetuate the system. That's the goal. So... In order to, like, the minimum requirements in order to do that, the minimum effort, the minimum amount of money spent in order to do that is something like standardized testing with the current system. I really think it's, like you said, it has its merit. Like, it's there for a reason. It's not just this arbitrarily silly or bad thing. Like, it's there because it perpetuates, because it helps continue the state on. So,
interesting.
If we did have an extremely forward-looking state, I think there could be something different. I'm not necessarily educated enough to outline that.
Nor am I.
In these fields. But at a very, very minimum, like Dewey, like you mentioned, Dewey talking about, like we've been talking about, we would like critical thinking as a core skill. We would like healthy communication as a core skill. That's one thing I've been considering given the current times. You can't talk with anyone right now about anything serious. They just rage or blow up or shut down or run away. Like, you don't have constructive conversation going on.
True that.
And that's... The education system doesn't teach it.
Absolutely.
We've taught ourselves that literally through this book club through the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And through other studies before that, because we've had a lot of effort.
This is a sidelight to the sidelight, but that's why I believed at one point that it was so important to repackage the book club, call it Trivium, and bring it to as wide of an audience as possible.
In order to bring that skill to more people.
This is why I believe that. I thought that was going to be the foundation of a new classical education system.
Well,
but that's a whole other sidelight.
Hopefully this book club, or this podcast, and the book club recordings will help some people get there. Just some, you know.
Whoever wants to. It's helped us, and nobody can do it but you. In the current climate, it seems, it has to be an individual thing.
You have to spend time, and that's hard.
It's interesting to me that at the very least we can say critical thinking might be a standard of success. And it's tough to do that when you're literally governed by a bell 8 hours a day, and the right answer is the right answer is the right answer. There's no term, there's a very little openness in this. You know, some schools are very good at it. I'm not going to write off schools. Different districts are better at that. But I would put something forward to you that critical thinking still might not be enough.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's true.
There's another thing over there.
I was just drawing that as baseline.
We need to invent a term for right now. A sort of existential awareness, perhaps. Or an awareness of one's being.
Yeah.
Or a captivating consciousness. That they're taught that they are conscious beings. They're not just images. Sometimes what people believe about themselves, I've seen this in my students, they believe the Instagram picture they take of themselves as their self-image more than they do their own consciousness of their existential being. And that was a very tough sentence, but what I'm trying to get at here is...
I'm following. Yep.
Their awareness of their self, their individuality, is not defined in any way. So they look for it any way they can, and they get it from social media. They look at the post they wrote, they look at the picture they took of themselves, and what people respond and say about them, and that is their self-perception.
Yeah. What comes to mind here is a couple things. Some people have formulated a model where you have become, the you being kind of an ambiguous person, we've become two beings. We've become a digital being and a physical being.
Oh, man.
And in this model, what people talk about in this model is generally that some people attribute more worth to one being or the other.
Hmm.
And increasingly, the two beings become different beings. They're not unified.
Oh, man.
And so you can see the cacophony of problems that come from this. Number one, you might not care about your physical self. Oof. Like, that's not going to work.
That's a big oof.
Number two is you might have a sort of existential crisis when you realize that your digital being is not you.
Yeah.
Like, not really. So that model might be helpful towards what you're talking about. Another thing that comes to mind is history education and we'll say civics education.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the Constitution when you were talking about we need to have people thinking about who they are. Because in this Constitution, we actually have claims of what people are in the form of God-given rights.
Broadly, yeah.
Yeah, and I think if everyone believed those God-given rights, they would have a real important sense of self because you would acknowledge those rights. Mm-hmm. And thereby, you couldn't help but acknowledge yourself.
Yeah.
You have meaning and importance when you have those rights.
There's so much to unpack there, too. I mean, how does the preamble go? We believe that all men are created equal. And, you know, yes, there is certain historical criticisms you can make of this document. Okay, that's fine. The way we backwards analyze it needs to be the way we accept it. All men, all women, all people are created equal. So right away, I'm not even going to talk about the theological problems that come up. It's almost like a theological document at that point. Created. Okay. We won't discuss that.
Yeah.
We won't discuss that. But let's just discuss the equal idea.
Sure.
Equal in what sense?
Right.
You know, these are never questions.
In existential worth. Like, that's, you know, it's great. Like, this is what I'm saying. If we really consider these things, you realize, wait, I am an autonomous human being who has worth. Intrinsically. Yeah. Existentially. Like, absolutely. So...
And that's not something that we ever get our students
I don't think
to.
The Constitution's taught in school, and if it is, it's such a surfacey level that nobody asks the question that you just asked. In what sense? And that's such a basic question. It's from the first line, and it's a begging the question sort of line.
Oh, yeah. That it does beg
Is that
question.
Ever asked?
Like, I mean, all that we really hear from it is the historical answer, which is that whether you are black, white, you know, whatever your sexual orientation is, and I agree with all of that. Yes, everybody's equal, but...
In what sense are they equal, you know? That's a good question.
What does that give you, you know? What do you get from that?
Right.
And why does that matter? So, it, that kind of existential awareness of one's infinitude, of one's utter continuation into the great unknown. You know, some people are comfortable believing that they will just cease to exist, but something in that first line is a whisper of the infinite.
It's because they're God-given that the infinite is so important. And whether you want to believe in God or not, you don't have a good basis for creating and accepting these rights unless you do believe in God. I've never heard of an atheist giving a justification for the rights in the Constitution.
Yeah.
Have you? Like, is there a reasoning for that?
If there is, it might be easy to take apart.
Exactly. It's shaky. It's evolutionary. It's temporal. It's going to fade with time. It's Nietzschean, you know?
It's based upon who the best bully is, who the aristocracy is, who the ruling class is.
And then how can we claim that all people are equal unless we're just trying to control people by convincing them so? Like,
yeah.
The atheistic view here is pretty rough because it's based in that biggest bully evolutionary thing that we were talking about.
Yeah, equally not exceptional might be the only thing we can go off of at that time. I heard somebody say with great emotion the other day, in this land, everyone will be the same. And I said, is that what you think equality means?
Be the same?
Everyone will be the same and have the same things?
What?
Yeah, so there's this failure of the school system to define equality in a way that actually makes sense. You know, we don't want everybody to have the same thing, necessarily. I mean, there are basic things we want everybody to have. Food, shelter, the stuff on Maslow's hierarchy.
You know, freedom, that's a good thing.
Yeah, Maslow's hierarchy gives some good things we want people to have, but some people work harder than others and end up being more exceptional. Some people do that.
And some people are in circumstances that they're given more than others.
Yeah.
We have to acknowledge that as well.
We do. But do we have the right as the state to then just, and now we're getting into the weeds. Okay. Focus back in.
Well, you did want to talk about current events and stuff that's going on in freedom. So we're right there.
I'm going to go ahead and talk about our next topic then. You know, the educational system might come up again because all of this is somewhat interrelated. Freedom carries with it responsibility. Are we comfortable with that statement?
I certainly am, but if you can, feel free to elaborate because
a
lot of people, like we've been talking about, might not have the
problem that I see here is that having the freedom to decide whether you want to do something dangerous, having the freedom whether you to decide whether you want to live on the frontiers of existence, you know, the best way I can think of it is the frontier analogy. They had the freedom to go to the dangerous lands where the Native American kingdoms were and where wild animals were and where all of this danger was. And I'm not going to talk about all of the very complex geopolitical, racial issues connected to that. Let's just talk about the individuals. They had freedom.
Yeah.
And it's been with us so long here in this country that we've almost forgotten the fact that that is a fragile, fragile thing. And I've woken up to this feeling of feeling the preciousness of freedom, but not knowing how to give any justification for freedom.
Mm.
Because I hear in the papers, I read the New York Times often, that there is this nobility in acquiescing and giving away portions of one's freedom for the greater good. So I see this civic responsibility that is preached towards me. I hear it. I acknowledge some of it, but I have difficulty giving away freedoms. I have difficulty doing that. And I think that the problem might be I have not defined what freedom is or defined why it's important to a society wherein we live. So that's the big question. How did we get where we are right now, where curfews have been declared all over the nation? You can't be on certain streets past 7 p.m.
Yeah.
You know, I broke that curfew. I got out one night on a Friday night and I drove and I saw my city and I saw boarded up windows, darkness on every street, a ghost town. And a policeman followed me out of the city to make sure I left. And I saw that and I said, what happened? How did we get here? So that's my question. How do we get to a place where there are curfews on the streets at ridiculously early child bedtimes and everyone is willing to get rid of freedom for a promise of safety? It's just very disturbing to me. I have to admit that I'm somewhat disturbed.
I mean, really, I would just let that rest and let our listeners ruminate on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
That's, like, I genuinely don't want to comment on it. Like, I really just take some time, think about that. That's why we're there, you know?
Yeah, because there's people on both sides of this issue in our generation. You know, my wife, I will admit right up, is a nurse dealing with the COVID issue. And it is a very real issue. But there's also the problem that for millennia, people have been dealing with the diseases and have not chosen to forego the living of life.
Yeah. You know, okay. So the place you started in this freedom discussion was the frontier. I think that might have been a confusing place for some people to start on this topic.
Sure.
But it's super apropos. It's the right place to think about this. Because that's what freedom meant constitutionally.
Yeah.
That's where we were historically when we were conceiving of freedom. And so just like we might not have good definitions for equality culturally, we don't have good definitions for freedom culturally.
Hmm.
Freedom has to be the ability to accept risk.
Hmm. Yeah.
What else do you want to be free for? What else are we restricted from that we need this concept of freedom in order to obtain?
Yeah.
The ability to accept risk. And freedoms are infringed all the time. We're never absolutely free. You're not free to kill yourself.
Yeah.
Theoretically, it's against the law. I don't... Like, it's impossible to... I mean... Maybe... That's why we have nice padded rooms. In certain buildings. So, you're not actually free to accept those risks and go on to eternity and figure out what's there.
Yeah.
You're not. Sorry. We live in a society where you can't. There's some societies where you can. You're also not free to infringe on other people's rights. This is sort of a libertarian idea.
Yeah.
Now, what does it mean to infringe on other people's rights? Because breathing air is actually infringing on other people's ability to breathe air, et cetera, et cetera. You have to draw a line somewhere.
Yeah.
Consuming any finite resource is infringing on other people's ability to consume those resources.
Mm.
So maybe air is not a great example because it can be renewed relatively easily,
but you
get my point. You know,
I definitely get your point. There are resources, and there are a limited amount of certain resources. Yeah. So
you can't be an absolute libertarian. It's not philosophically sound.
Mm.
However, you know, where you draw the line on freedom, it is hard, and so that's why we have the civilization that we have today, where we have infringed, the cities especially, have infringed upon their inhabitants' freedoms.
Mm.
You're still free to move out of the city, I suppose, except monetarily you're probably not. You know, you're in the city for a reason.
Absolutely.
That's why urbanization has been such a massive thing globally, especially over the last century.
Yeah.
You can just go and research those statistics. It's startling to see how many people are now in urban centers as compared to what it used to be.
So, folks, what you might be getting from this is that we have been studying for over 2 years, and we have only just now been able to ask these questions that theoretically should affect every aspect of our daily lives in our country. Equality, freedom under the law, and there are probably a million topics that just got brought up in the past 20 minutes because, ultimately, we've only just now been able to conceive of how difficult of questions these are.
Yeah.
And
effectively
how important they are.
One of the things we're pointing out here is how poorly equipped we are as highly educated individuals to even approach these questions. And to me, this is just highlighting the dangers of the populace trying to address these questions. Not to say they shouldn't, but to say we can't. You and I can't.
Yeah.
And the people spouting all sorts of things about it, certainly, at least from the people I've seen, have no right, have no basis for believing that they actually have the right answers.
You know, I remember
I'll say that.
Years,
they have every right to try.
For years in my right-wing world, I was able to get, yeah, everybody's free, everybody's equal. America. What does that even mean? I had no idea back then, and in my pride, I thought I knew what it meant.
Yeah.
And now, we're just now opening Pandora's box in what should be the foundation of our society. Even that is difficult. You know, think it'd be the simplest thing, the easiest thing to understand, but these things are difficult.
So, I want to maybe encourage our listeners, we're not going to go down a political road in the following weeks. We are going to be philosophical in the following weeks. That's not to say we won't comment on current-ish events by the time these get published. But that is to say, this is the Narratives in Philosophy podcast, and we will be building narratives through the history of philosophy.
And what narratives are most useful? Probably the ones that happen in your present-day life. So join us in these discussions. Join us in these conversations. There's ways to contact us to share your opinions on the site. There's ways for you to get involved in the book club.
Yeah.
If you want to get involved, we are in cyberspace.
PositivePerspectives.net is the main website. You can always reach us just mail@PositivePerspectives.net if you'd like to email.
Yeah.
Certainly, you can leave comments on any of the posts we have there. Certainly, we would appreciate reviews, ratings, feedback, not just arbitrarily good ratings, but feedback on anywhere our podcasts are published that will be personally reviewed by us. Next week, metaphysics, I believe.
Yeah, next week, the Platonic metaphysics, perhaps also some Aristotelian thought in there.
A little bit of Duns Scotus, if our listeners know who that is.
The univocity of being, such great words to define.
Yeah.
But thank you for joining us this week on the positive... I almost did it.
Thank
you for joining us this week on the Narratives in Philosophy podcast. This has been your hosts, Jacob and Brandon, asking questions about being itself, and we hope that you will join us in asking these questions and getting to a heightened awareness of your humanity. Signing off.